Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Governor John Kasich says that drilling for natural gas with the horizontal hydraulic fracturing method in the Utica Shale in eastern Ohio has the potential to transform the state's economically depressed Appalachian region.
They have been in depression in the eastern part of this state, and now they can have revitalization. And it is not just those people who drill, but let me tell you, if you make widgets, if you make pumps, if you make pipes, if you are in an industry where you can use natural gas to reduce your costs and power your product, folks, this is huge.
Some environmental advocates say the governor is moving too fast before we know the risks of a new and more invasive drilling technology. Later on this hour, we welcome back Tom Stewart. He's the executive vice president of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Joining us now is Seamus McGraw. Seamus is a journalist and the author of a new book called The End of Country. It's a story about what happened in 2007 when the natural gas industry arrived in rural Pennsylvania and began a bidding war for drilling rights to land over the Marcellus Shale. He grew up pitching hay and spreading manure on the same fields the gas companies are now prospecting. He still lives in the woods of northeastern Pennsylvania with his wife and four children, and we welcome him to the program by telephone. Welcome to the show, Seamus.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You have said, well, first of all, the book's been called a cautionary tale. It's not an indictment of the industry per se, but you've said that natural gas is an imperfect short-term solution to the nation's energy problems. How is it imperfect from where you sit?
It's imperfect for a couple of reasons. The first reason, of course, is, look, this stuff offers, the governor's not mistaken when he says that this offers a real opportunity to areas that have been suffering tremendously, not just because of kind of the decline of the Rust Belt as you've experienced in your state, the decline of the farming economy over decades. It does offer a lifeline to some degree to these people and to the industries there, but it also carries with it tremendous risks. The risks are really threefold. Tony Ingraffia, a professor up at Cornell who's been very critical of the Marcellus development, cites three areas. He cites the danger of fracking fluid, and we'll get into this, migrating up from below, which he terms as being unlikely. Unlikely in scientific speak translated into English means it's probably not going to happen. The second is methane contamination from higher deposits of methane. We've seen that happen. That's a mechanical problem that may have a mechanical solution. The third problem is surface spills, which we've also seen happen. That's also largely a mechanical problem and a problem of human error. There's a fourth problem that I think Tony and a lot of people who are very critical of going forward with this overlook. And the fourth danger that we face is the danger of doing nothing. We are tremendously dependent on oil, and we are tremendously dependent on what I believe is the deadliest and most destructive form of energy. In our state, more than half of our electricity comes from coal. This gives us an opportunity to wean ourselves, even if slightly, from those two sources of energy. The question is, do we have the character? Do we have the character to do this in a responsible way? And that, to me, is still very much an open question. If you're looking at this book, if you're looking for a polemic, if you're looking for, as one person put it, gasland on paper, or if you're looking at it as one of T. Boone Pickens' treatises on natural gas, it's not either. What it is a look at people trying to do the right thing under very difficult circumstances.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest right now, Seamus McGraw. He's an author and journalist. His newest book, The End of Country. It's a story about what happened in 2007 when the natural gas industry arrived in rural Pennsylvania and began a bidding war for drilling rights to land over the Marcellus Shale. We are talking about this because an energy company has decided that there's about $20 billion worth of natural gas and oil beneath the surface of eastern Ohio, largely depressed area and in need of economic help. Seamus, You said the question. One of the questions is, do we have the character to be responsible managers of this energy source? But concurrently, are you confident that the powers that be will take advantage of the reprieve that natural gas will give us and work on long-term solutions to the nation's energy problems?
No,
or is
I'm not. I'm not at all sanguine about that, Anna.
Okay.
And this is a very serious issue for me. And it has been 40 years since we hit Hubbard's peak. The predicted peak of oil production in the United States. It is 30 years since Ronald Reagan ripped the solar panels off the roof of the White House. And we have no energy policy in this country. We have not developed one. Instead, we turn around and kind of hide behind our ideological barricades and collect whatever data supports our particular position and shout epithets at each other. We're not achieving anything. We have not had an energy policy in this country since the end of World War II. I was listening to the governor's quote there, and yes, there is certainly the potential in terms of reducing our dependency on some of these other fossil fuels, and we should be exploiting that. There's also the possibility, as he points out, of ancillary industries benefiting from this, but it could go even further. It could go even further, and there's no guidance or leadership in going in that direction. This could not only provide the fuel source for our electrical generation, it could provide transportation, it could provide in terms of fleet transportation and those sorts of things. The irony is that the industry itself isn't even using this stuff to get this stuff. I was out at a drill rig in Western Pennsylvania not too long ago, and I was having this discussion about all the tremendous benefits that could come of natural gas with an executive from one of the companies out there. We're driving back to from the rig, and we get about halfway back, the guy starts white knuckling the steering wheel and staring down at his gas gauge and realizing that this big Ford Explorer we're driving in may not have enough gas to get back to the office. And the irony of that was completely lost on him. Here we are. We're sitting on top of, in the Marcellus, what may very well be the second, is largely regarded as the third largest natural gas field in the world. And yet we're not using it to its full potential. And there is no series of incentives to do that. There are a number of industries, plastics, agriculture, the nitrogen that we use to revitalize the soil after we grow so much corn, not just for foodstuffs but for biofuels, is largely extracted from natural gas, from this sort of thing. And yet we have no plan to actually maximize the benefits of this. That said, Ann, Terry Ann Gelder, who's a professor at Penn State, who is one of the guys who first recognized the potential for this stuff, he said to me, you know what, this is still a fossil fuel. And if we're still burning this in 30 years, we're in trouble. So the reality is, this buys us back a little bit of the time we've wasted over the last 40 years. It doesn't buy back all of it. It buys back some of it. And whether or not we use it to its full potential and then use that time to develop alternatives is, to me, very much an open question.
A recent Bloomberg article says that trade associations have reported that natural gas and related industries have created some 72,000 jobs, 3,143 well permits, and more than $1 billion in tax revenue in Pennsylvania just since 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you have said that the promised financial benefits have yet to be realized.
Yes.
Are we talking about two different things here?
No, we're not necessarily. Yes, there is a certain amount of there is a certain amount of initial impact. You had a land rush, of course, and a leasing rush, and you've had certain ancillary benefits that have arisen. You're starting to see, to some degree, a revitalization of the steel industry in Eastern Ohio and in Western Pennsylvania, manufacturing for this. But this is only a fraction of what we could be developing. we are right now, the vast majority, a significant part of, let me put it that way, a significant part of the workforce that's working on this is an out-of-state workforce that's imported. We went 20 years with no oil and gas industry to speak of in the state of Pennsylvania, and during that 20 years, we lost the ability to train people, not just for these jobs, but also for the regulatory agencies. We're starting to rebuild that, but of course, the taxpayers in Pennsylvania are footing the bill for that. There is some contribution from the industry, but it's not an institutionalized, it's not a legally required contribution. We're investing right now in terms of, you'd be amazed how many hotels are being built, how many restaurants, and that's all well and good for the short term. But over the long term, that's not the kind of investment that's going to really pay off, because if we really are trying to develop a local workforce, then those things are going to be unnecessary.
It sounds like a gold rush type of...
There is very much a gold rush type of thing. And see, there are two models of an economy out of a resource state. You can have either the colonial model or the industrial model. And the reality is, the history of Pennsylvania, and I think to a lesser degree the history of Ohio, has been the history of the colonial model, where the resource is extracted and shipped out, and whatever economic benefit happens only at the extraction level. In this situation, we have an opportunity not just to be the producers of this stuff, but we have the opportunity to be, at least again, for a period of time, the consumers of this stuff. We can use it for our chemical companies. We can use it for our generation of power. 53% of our electricity in the state of Pennsylvania comes from coal. We could be using natural gas. We could be using it for our steel mills, which is what they do in Russia, which is another large gas producer and our probably biggest world competitor as this thing goes forward. But we're not using it. We haven't looked beyond the immediate. We haven't taken the long view of this.
When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Seamus McGraw. He's author of the book, The End of Country, Story About What Happened When the Natural Gas Industry Arrived in Rural Pennsylvania about 4 years ago now, I guess, in 2007. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Get access to our station anytime online. Hear local and national news all day, every day from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Live link on the left-hand side of the page. Listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime online at WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from Fahlgren Mortine, whose wider perspective on marketing can help your brand grow through advertising, public relations, and a full range of communications. Think wider at fahlgrenmortine.com.
73 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunny skies today will reach a high of 85 this afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 63. Sunshine for Thursday with a chance of rain and a high of 85. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Ohio Governor John Kasich has called it a revolution coming to Ohio. Chesapeake Energy has said that billions of dollars worth of oil and gas lie beneath the surface of eastern Ohio. That could mean big bucks for the struggling region. It meant big bucks in Pennsylvania. We're talking with Seamus McGraw about his new book, End of Country. It's an account of what happens when big energy companies, including Chesapeake, come calling in rural America. You mentioned the long term, you know, the long view of all of this. I wanted to go back just quickly and talk about the short view and literally and figuratively the short view. What are people seeing in Pennsylvania where these drilling operations are going up? In Ohio, and we'll be talking with Tom Stewart from the Ohio Oil and Gas Association coming up later, but they're saying you won't even know it's there. You'll barely be able to hear it. There, you know, it'll just operate. We'll barely even notice it. So in that sense, there will be very little environmental disruption. But, you know, there has been in April a Chesapeake blew a well out in Pennsylvania. It caused thousands of gallons of fracking fluid to spill into a nearby stream, and there are other considerations in the short term. What do people see in Pennsylvania now that all of these operations have gone up?
It depends on where you're standing in. The reality is this is an industrial operation. There are no two ways about it. You're seeing what happens when they come in and develop a well with the horizontal drilling. The horizontal drilling requires a drill pad that covers about 3 to 5 acres. It is, for a period of time, it is an intense industrial operation. You have hundreds of trucks coming up. You have dozens of workers. You have a rig going day and night. Run all of this, by the way, on diesel.
Back to your other point, right?
That I keep making. Right. And it is a very, very, very disruptive sort of thing while it's going on. Now, it is also true that there is a narrow window during which each of these wells go through this. But
how narrow? About how long does that take?
You're talking about a period. Depending on how they operate, it's a matter of weeks to drill a well. There's usually a lull. It's a matter of, you know, a week to 10 days, a little bit longer to bring in the operation to frack the well. What they're doing now to reduce the footprint, and it's significant, is to do multiple wells from a single pad.
Okay.
But I need to make a very important point here. Mm-hmm. There is a tendency among people who are not from the country to view the country as being sort of this pristine place, as I put it in the book, like a flower you could press into the pages of a book, that it is what it always was. And this is not the case. The area where my farm is and where the drilling is, one of the sweet spots, one of the two sweet spots of the Marcellus in the Northeast, this is an area that has had an industry for 250 years, a couple of industries. It's had farming, and farming was dying out, largely because of the price of energy, quite frankly, and taking with it a lot of the opportunities. It had timbering, and it continues to have stone. So the idea that this is something new, and that it used to be just diesel tractors. There aren't any more diesel tractors because nobody's farming. Now there are trucks. Is it more intensive than it was? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And is it creating a strain on the local infrastructure? Yes, it is.
The roads and so forth.
The roads, mm-hmm, and those sorts of things. There are contributions being made to that effect, but again, they're not standardized. We don't do it through policy. We do it largely through the good graces of the companies, which is fine. Some of them have good graces. Not all of them do.
You know, you put a lot of faith in the people of northeastern Pennsylvania as the stewards of the environment. You said that in the vacuum of U.S. government leadership, the residents there are the only ones speaking up about how the drilling is managed.
Absolutely. Here's the situation in Pennsylvania, Ann. When this, as I pointed out, we went 20 years in this state without, for all intents and purposes, a real oil and gas industry. And it was during that 20-year period that the technology to exploit these shales really developed. Yes, fracking has been around for a very long time, but the real evolution in both directional drilling and slick water fracking really happened during the last 20 years. And that was the period of time when we were fundamentally dormant in the state of Pennsylvania. And so it was a remarkable game of catch-up. And I give former Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, John Hanger, immense credit for being able to take this sleeping agency, the DEP, and bring it to within a step or a half step of where the industry was. But that's as close as we're ever going to get in terms of regulation, because the industry is always going to be evolving a half step ahead of us or a full step ahead of us. And so it really does devolve down onto the people on the ground. And when I talk about the people on the ground, yes, I'm talking about my friends in Dimmock and my friends in Susquehanna County and Wyoming County and the friends I have yet to make in eastern Ohio. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's their responsibility, but it's all of our responsibilities. What happened, you know, Dimmock to many people has become kind of ground zero for what could go wrong. And you had a fairly significant problem with methane migration in Dimmock. It's still in dispute by the company, but the state has largely concluded that it was as a result of improper cementing, that these wells were not properly sealed off from higher levels of natural gas.
Is this the methane that's lighting people's faucets?
You know, that's a bit of an exaggeration.
Okay.
We have always had, particularly in the Northeast, a significant amount of floating methane, free-floating methane. Mm-hmm. Some of it biogenic, some of it thermogenic. The problem is we knew that problem existed. And steps should have been taken while the drilling was taking place to isolate that stuff. And I don't believe that adequate steps were done to do that. That's certainly the state's position. The irony here, and this is what I talk about the vigilance of the people on the ground, mm-hmm. long before the state ever concluded what had happened, long before the industry ever concluded what had happened with this drifting methane, one of the key characters in my book, a guy named Ken Ely, said to me, he said, "This isn't an engineering problem. This isn't a geology problem. This is a plumbing problem." He understood what the problem was. He understood what had happened because he knew the land. He knew the lay of the land. He knew what was underneath the land. But, you know, people weren't listening to Ken. They weren't listening to Ken. They weren't listening to the people on the ground. There was a spill in that same community of 8,000 gallons over 3 days of fracking fluid. There you had a situation where the well pad had been designed by somebody who really didn't understand the topography of Pennsylvania, the mountainous topography of Pennsylvania, and failed to calculate in questions like temperature and height differential.
I mean, even I think about temperature of soil. And isn't someone getting paid big bucks to do exactly these kinds of calculations?
Absolutely, but you know what? You know what? There is still a level of you have to have boots on the ground, and those boots on the ground have to be people who understand the geology, understand the topography, understand the way the land works, and understand the culture of the place. And when we talk, this goes back to some degree to that economic question. You know, this is what we need to develop in Pennsylvania. This is what you're going to need to develop in Ohio. You're going to need to develop the local boys who know how this stuff works if you're going to do this safely. And in the meantime, it is the people who understand this place, who understand these places, who are the ones who are the most effective watchdogs. And I will say this, too. The industry has been somewhat responsive since the incidents that occurred in Dimmock and in places like that, but largely because these people also understood the value of speaking up.
Mm-hmm. Bob in Springfield, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You're a guest. Spoke earlier about the fact that this country doesn't have an energy policy, and I've heard the term energy policy forever. What is an energy policy?
Good question, Bob.
You know what? An energy, Bob, I'll give it to you this way. There is, frankly, no more pervasive issue in our country than energy, because it touches on every other aspect of our lives. It's economic. It's national security. It involves education. It involves health care. It involves everything that we do. And when we talk about an energy policy, we tend to talk about, are we going to subsidize a few more wind farms, or are we going to turn around and continue to give tax breaks to the oil companies? It's got to be far more far-reaching than that. We have to turn around and reduce our dependency on foreign oil. We have to wean ourselves from, and when I say foreign oil, that's really a misstatement, because the truth is oil is oil. It's fungible. A 2% disruption in the world's oil supply sends prices of oil skyrocketing 40%, regardless of where that disruption is. We need to wean ourselves from coal. But more importantly, we need to plug the economy in going forward into the energy sources that we're developing, so that we maximize the economic benefit of this, and that we, and so we minimize the environmental impact of it.
How does that happen at the federal level or at the state level?
At the state level, what you really need to do, you need to understand that at the federal level, quite frankly, in with the kind of partisan gridlock that we're facing right now, it is unlikely that we're going to come up with an energy policy, because everybody is far more focused on protecting their duchies and their baronies than they are in really addressing the most critical issue that we face in this country. On the state level, there are ways of doing it. And the first way to do it is to turn around and bring the stakeholders together. And when I talk about the stakeholders, I'm talking about everybody. I'm talking about the environmental community. I'm talking about the academics. I'm talking about agriculture. I'm talking about transportation. I'm talking about energy. I'm talking about all of these people, manufacturing, everything up and down the line. Bring them together. Turn around and say, block them in a room for 3 weeks and say, you know what? I want you to solve this problem. You have to, right now, use nothing but this fuel to operate and expand your operation. Tell me how you're going to do it. Once you do that, then you could begin to turn around and start to pick up the pieces of that you could use. We can do that on a state level because, despite the fact that we still have those fissures on the state level that we have on the federal level, at the very least on the state level, we're all in it together. The important role for the federal government in this is turning around and establishing a baseline, a minimum level of supervision that needs to be a lot stronger than it is right now, a minimum level of regulation that needs to be a lot stronger than it is right now, and to turn around and, once these things are developed, once these things are in place, develop a tax structure that rewards these guys in the industry for doing what, quite frankly, is in their own best interest to do, and penalizes them for not doing it. We need to understand, and this is a very important part, when we have this discussion in this country, again, getting back to the polemics, we tend to view the oil and gas guys, they tend to be depicted either as sort of these rugged cowboys riding off on the frontier of America's energy future, you know, we're America's natural gas companies, and this is what we did today, or they tend to be viewed as mustache-twirling villains. They're not either. They're not either. They're corporations. They're interested in turning around and maximizing their benefits. That's their profits. That's their responsibility. There is a way. There is a way that we can have a shared purpose in this. There is a way that we can turn around and help those industries maximize their benefits, maximize their profits, and at the same time do, again, for the medium term, good for all of us. There is a way to do that. But again, do we have the character? Do we have the will?
Thanks to Bob for that call. Jack in Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You're talking with Seamus McGraw, author of The End of Country.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Ann. Hi, Seamus.
Hi, Jack.
I was going to ask two questions, but I'll try to make it. When I was in Florida, I think it was 2009, and I really didn't pay much attention to any of these environmental questions about energy until I heard a legislator on on their public TV down there say that if in the event that Florida has problems with its water, we are going to make sure that the natives of Florida get the water, and the rest are just the guests. And that really struck me, that Florida was considering that if they ever had a water issue in Florida, that the people who they considered the natives of Florida would be the ones that would get the water. Have we looked at Ohio like that? Has anybody done an environmental study that said, what does happen if we ruin our water table? And I'm all for what we're doing. We have to have energy. We all know that. Alternative energy doesn't seem to be doing much. We definitely need the energy. But is anybody looking long forward into this thing?
There are certainly people in Pennsylvania. I don't really know what the status is in terms of Ohio, but it would be the industry itself, to some degree, to give some of them credit, has been looking at this issue. But again, because it's in their self-interest, the industry took quite a beating in Pennsylvania when they were the last guys in and were viewed as a significant contributor to elevated levels of total dissolved solids in the Monongahela. There were a number of factors that went along with that, but that was one of them. The issue of water usage has been widely regulated in the state of Pennsylvania. We have most of our major tributaries, the Susquehanna, the Delaware, are operated basically by multi-state agencies, and so we've been very rigorous. I give them a great deal of credit in terms of water usage. Recently, they cut back on the water usage, and there's been great pressure on the industry, and the industry, to its credit, because it saw the handwriting on the wall, has begun recycling. The wastewater produced by this is probably the most pernicious or the most serious threat, and the natural water produced from the shale itself is the most pernicious of that. And the industry recently has started recycling a lot of that water. It still needs to use a lot of the water. But when I talk about shared mutual interest, here's a perfect example of that. The industry started doing the recycling in no small part because of the public outcry over the risks of groundwater contamination, the risk of spills and that sort of thing, the risk of this stuff being discharged into rivers, which we have curtailed in the state of Pennsylvania. And it was an opportunity for them, basically, to diffuse a difficult situation in Pennsylvania. But interestingly enough, and here's a question where you see what's in their interest. Texas right now, they were very much in danger of having to drop some of their drilling rigs in Texas because, quite frankly, a prolonged drought there was making water very, very difficult to come by.
Right.
They are now able to, because of recycling, because of something that was done for an entirely different purpose, and which some of them in the industry really resisted, is now turning around and throwing them a little bit of a bone that helps them continue their operations in Texas. So, again, when I talk about trying to find these mutual benefits, these are the sorts of things I'm talking about.
My guest is Seamus McGraw. He is the journalist. He's a journalist, and he's the author of a new book called The End of Country. It's about what happened in Pennsylvania when the big natural gas industry arrived and started a bidding war for drilling rights to land over the Marcellus Shale there. I want to say thanks to Jack and Dayton for that call, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
It's easy to renew your 89.7 NPR News membership. You can visit WOSU.org/renew to make your contribution for another year. Your online renewal means less paperwork for 89.7 NPR News, and that means more of your donation supports the programs you enjoy. And while online, don't forget to set your membership to renew automatically. It's a quick, easy, and efficient way to show your support and can help reduce on-air fundraising. Visit WOSU.org/renew for more information.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. And in 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, we'll have a discussion of the Pelotonia and also taxes during wartime. And you can join WOSU TV tonight as researchers grapple with the harshest conditions on the planet and venture to Antarctica to discover astonishing new clues about the continent's past and the Earth's future. Watch NOVA, Secrets Beneath the Ice. It's tonight at 9 on WOSU TV. Sunny skies today, a nice summer day, a high of 85 degrees. It's currently 73 degrees. And partly cloudy tonight, a low of 63. Sunshine for Thursday. There is a chance of showers and thunderstorms popping up Thursday afternoon, a high of 85. And looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny, a high of 84. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Ohio Governor John Kasich calls it a revolution coming to Ohio. Chesapeake Energy has said that billions of dollars worth of oil and gas lie beneath the surface of eastern Ohio. Chesapeake has reported that those resources could add as much as $20 billion to its bottom line. What and how would it benefit eastern Ohio? Still with us is Seamus McGraw, journalist and author of a new book called The End of Country. It's about when the natural gas industry arrived in rural Pennsylvania and began a bidding war for drilling rights to land over the shale there. Welcome back, Seamus.
Thank you.
Also joining us now to talk about that is Tom Stewart. He's Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Welcome back, Tom.
Good morning, Ann.
When Chesapeake Energy talks about $20 billion worth, how do you extrapolate that in terms of the benefit to Ohio?
When Chesapeake speaks about that, they're basing it upon several tests that they've drilled on the eastern side of the Utica play, and then evaluating what that data shows them and extrapolating it across. There's a lot of work to be done. This is a very fresh play, and I think that those are very generalized numbers.
Right. So when they're talking about $20 billion, though, they're talking about what it's worth to them.
To
as
them
far
alone.
As the industry and the impact of the drilling and the everything that has to do with it, all the ancillary benefits. Has anyone counted those up yet? The governor's vague.
There's two different efforts underway to count those up. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce is working on economic study under an umbrella called a Shale Coalition that will give a broader business perspective on what this means. Mr. McGraw brought up the Chemical Council. I think that's a great example. The chemical industry is reentering the United States to take advantage of these, of a feedstock that is now discounted 25% to its intrinsic energy value. So people are coming back in the United States to do what Mr. McGraw, I think, wants them to do, which is to use this resource and make good advantage of it while it's practical to do so as we start thinking about what happens in the future. I'm with Mr. McGraw. I'm very sympathetic to his concern that there is no energy policy that brings people together for the common good. I think he's right on.
Seamus, one report about your book says that there's a lot of savvy advice in it about how to cut the very best deal, and that the book is a must-read for everyone in the Marcellus Shale region of Ohio. And from what you know, could eastern Ohioans benefit from the experience of Pennsylvania? Are they parallel, or do they maybe intersect at some point?
I think there are a number of similarities, and I think some of the cautions need to be some of the precautions we took by the time we actually signed, I think, are the kinds of things that that people need to look at. You need to be as proactive as possible. And one other thing that I need to point out to anybody who's considering signing a lease, look at your estate plan. I hate to get that prosaic, but the reality is a lot of people are looking at these prices coming in, and you get this upfront payment, and you've got these royalty payments if, in fact, the Utica produces, as some people believe it will. And remember, the Utica isn't just a gas play. The Utica is a gas and oil play.
Right.
But there's also another advantage to the Utica over the eastern part of the Marcellus as opposed to the western part of the Marcellus, which is that it's also got wet gas, which means that there are other elements that can be drawn out of that and marketed as well, stuff like butane and pentane and whatnot. But it's very, very important that anybody who's considering signing a lease really develop an estate plan. And because what happens is that you've got this money coming in at the beginning. You may have royalties coming through at the end, but when these properties change hands through inheritance, they're subject to inheritance tax. And that's taxed at the lifetime production of the well. So you may not see the cash flow coming in to do that. So I would advise anybody who's considering this to do that.
A federal Department of Energy panel last week issued recommendations for improving the safety and environmental impact of drilling in shale formations for natural gas, and I imagine oil and all the rest of it. Better tracking and more careful disposal of the waste that comes up from the well, stricter standards on air pollution and greenhouse gases mm-hmm. associated with it. Given, you know, the attention paid to the increase in fracking, Tom, Stuart, was that expected, and is this stuff welcomed and embraced by the industry?
I testified in front of the DOE panel that issued that report 3 weeks ago, and it was an interesting process. They did come out and say that that the risk of groundwater contamination is so de minimis that they really ought to concentrate on other things. One of the other things that they concentrated on is something that Mr. McGraw actually calls for, which is to bring stakeholders together, the environmental community, state regulators, the industry, and to peer critique state regulatory programs, identify where there are gaps, identify where there are strengths and where there are gaps, seek improvements to bolster those state regulatory programs to meet the public good. That's a process called STRONGER, the state review process, and that appears to be exactly what Mr. McGraw is driving forward, and that's what the DOE in their issues, when they issued their report, their draft report there, said that needs to be enhanced and supported.
Absolutely. One other thing I'd throw into that, you mentioned the air pollution, and that's separate and apart from, and the greenhouse gases, separate and apart from the fact that we continue to use diesel to get natural gas. There's also the issue of, you know, the recent study out of Cornell, which is it's controversial, but the underlying point is pretty solid. And the underlying point is that when we burn this stuff, it burns 30% cleaner than oil. It burns 50% cleaner than coal. But although it's shorter lived, when it drifts unburned into the atmosphere, it is a very serious greenhouse gas. And there is a lot more that we could be doing to reduce the amount of stuff that we're losing from the wellhead to the end user. And again, it's one of these things that is in the industry's interest to do it. Even if you take the most optimistic number, that we're losing 1% of this stuff, that's still a lot of the industry's cash that's drifting off into the atmosphere. It's in their interest to correct this problem. They have the technology to do it. It's a very expensive thing to do, but it's a very expensive thing not to do. And again, here's a situation where we need to develop a policy that encourages the industry to do what is in the industry's interest and what is in our interest.
Which is why Stronger is adding the air issue to their mm-hmm. guidelines for mm-hmm. doing peer critique reviews of state regulatory mm-hmm. programs. Mm-hmm.
The panel also called for the creation of a federal database to better monitor drilling operations and the elimination of carcinogenic diesel fuel from the fracking fluid. And Don in Cincinnati, you wanted to talk about the fracking fluid. Welcome to the show. Hi, Don.
Hello. Yes, I want to talk about the fracking fluid and its effects on water. There was a lot of points that were made that weren't really followed up on. I don't know if the recycling system that Mr. Allen was speaking of would include any holding tanks or if they intend to recycle back into the streams. The area of the gas range here that we're talking about, I forget the name of it here, starts with an M.
Here you go.
Okay. Is rather vast. It reaches from the mountains on up towards the Great Lakes. You've so far cleverly talked about how there won't be too much contamination of surface water, and the gas that we saw in the TV shows coming out of the person's sink faucet was some kind of an anomaly that really doesn't matter.
That's not what I said.
That's not true.
You said it was small and insignificant.
No, that's not what I said. What I said was that this was a situation that we have experienced over the history of these areas, and that what we probably ran into in that situation, and the one you're referring to is the one in Gasland, and the state of Colorado there basically determined that that was an already occurring phenomenon in that area. But more importantly, the question is, what precautions do the drillers take when they're drilling into an area where they know that there is this level of drifting methane? Are they taking the appropriate precautions? I would argue that in Dimock, that certainly wasn't always the case.
Let's talk a little bit more about the fracking fluid. The panel also calls for a full disclosure by the companies and regulators of the ingredients used in fracking. Why the secrets in the first place, Tom Stewart?
There is no secrets in the state of Ohio. Last year, the General Assembly passed one of the most advanced oil and gas upgrades, upgrading the Ohio law to probably the 33 producing states. As part of that, there is full disclosure on what happens on fracturing operations, including complete submittal of what's called frac charts and frac
In every permit process. And
and the DNR is required to list on their website all the MSDS sheets of all of everything that is used. The operator submits all that information. On a national level, there's a website called Frac Focus that's put together by Groundwater Protection Council that many states are now considering. One has already mandated requiring producers to go and list the chemicals that they're using. The producers have no problem talking about what's in the frac fluid, and there's no problem with disclosure. It's often the pumping companies, the fracturing companies, that are, for competitive reasons, try to hold some of that information proprietary.
How has that worked? Has that been the case in Pennsylvania, Seamus?
Pennsylvania recently passed a law very similar to the one that that Tom was talking about. The materials themselves, we know. The concentrations of the various materials remains an open question in a lot of places. In Pennsylvania, the full disclosure takes place. It does take place, but it takes place. We know what's going into the well. We just don't necessarily know the concentrations. We get everything when the well is completed. I think in Pennsylvania, we probably want to do that the other way, but other states have been embracing this. There is a tendency among some in the industry, and Tom is right. It is largely the guys that are coming in and doing the fracking themselves, or the companies that manufacture some of these products, that simply want to protect their trade secrets, and they throw such a level of secrecy over it that I think it exacerbates a feeling of mistrust. You know, I was out at a place one time, one of these pumping companies, and a guy handed me basically a pile of pocket lint. I said, "This looks like pocket lint." He says, "Well, it's sand, but this bit is basically pocket lint, but it's Halliburton pocket lint, so it's secret and it's really, really expensive."
Thank you, Don, for that call. Rick in Grandview Heights, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My comment is about consumers, our consumer habits. It was mentioned that maybe this would give us a 30-year window. We continue to believe that the energy out there to be used seems limitless.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to... I would like to see a change in consciousness and behavior before we jumped into another energy field, energy source, not a new energy source, but more resources that would just lead people to believe that we can still find it forever.
Could I field that one, Ann? Would you mind?
Go ahead, Seamus, and then Tom Stewart can jump in afterward.
Here's my feeling on this. I don't disagree with you at all that we need to be turning around and devoting every bit of energy we've got to developing alternatives. But right now we have 16 wind farms in the state of Pennsylvania that generate about 11% of our electricity, and we're doing well. The reality is we are decades away from being able to rely on this stuff as anything more than a very effective tool of conservation. It's a very effective tool of conservation, and it's something that we really, really, really need to embrace, but it's not going to solve our problems. And not pursuing other forms that buy us that time is, I think, reckless. And I say that because of this. I know a number of people that I've spoken to have made the suggestion that, well, we should just stop using fossil fuels or stop developing alternative fossil fuels, alternate fossil fuels, until we can turn around and make the switch to renewables. If we do that, we're all going to have to reduce our energy consumption, not by 11%, to 11%. And those who are going to suffer the most as a result of that, those who would suffer the most as a result of that, are those who can least afford it. Those who can afford to heat their pools with solar panels, they'll be fine.
Yeah, that's true.
The rest of us, not so much. I've actually had, and I talk about it in the book, I actually had one woman quote Malthus to me. You know, the idea of, you know, this is the survival of the fittest meme. And I made the argument to her that in the 200 years since Malthus said that and since Darwin picked up on it, we've changed the meme. The capitalist culture has changed that meme. It's not survival of the fittest anymore. It's survival of the richest. And you may be able to convince me that there has to be some kind of collateral damage if we're going to turn around and embrace alternatives immediately. I may accept that principle, but you cannot get me to jettison 4,000 years of the ethical teaching of every major tradition in the world to accept the idea that that burden has to fall disproportionately on the people who can least afford to bear it.
Tom Stewart, last word?
Well, that's a pretty heavy thought.
We're almost out of time.
I'm not sure how to respond to Mr. McCall's statement about that. You had me flabbergasted for once there. The bottom line is that... If we were to do what the caller suggests, the degradation of the American lifestyle would be dramatic, and people would be very upset. And people would no longer be able to go and get on a plane and fly to California to see grandma again because they simply could not afford it, and nobody wants to get into a horse-drawn wagon and do the same thing. So fossil fuels have advanced society. We need to use it. We need to extract it, and we need to use it wisely. And I think Mr. McGraw has made some wonderful points.
Seamus McGraw, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was been a lot of fun. And Tom, stop calling me Mr. McGraw.
Seamus is a journalist and the author of a new book. It's called The End of Country. Also with us today, Tom Stewart. He's executive vice president of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Tom, thanks for coming back today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.